Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It takes 2 million minutes to live through high school, whether you're in the U.S. or India or China. Who's making the most of that time is the question at the heart of a new documentary that goes deep into high school life and education in those three global competitors. The film takes a deep look at how each country is preparing its teens to compete in the 21st century. The side-by-side comparison is sobering and fascinating. This hour, On Point, we get up close as the U.S., China, and India go to high school. Joining me in the studio is Bob Compton. He's a venture capitalist turned filmmaker. He's the executive producer of a new documentary, 2 Million Minutes. Bob Compton, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
Bill Gates' money behind this film? What's the relationship?
My own money.
Your own money.
I funded the film entirely myself. After I completed the film, the Gates Foundation and the Broad Foundation, through their Ed in 08 initiative for the
Ed as in education,
in 08 to get the education higher on the presidential agenda, saw the film, felt like it was a perfect fit, and so they are sponsoring me to fly around the country and screen it in the primary states in Washington, D.C., New York, major cities.
Great. We've got the background. You're a venture capitalist. We get that. So what are you doing sending cameras into classrooms around the world, at least in Indiana and Shanghai and Bangalore? Why?
Right. Well, I've been a venture capitalist for 20 years, and I've either operated, owned, or invested in companies in Europe, obviously in the U.S., and India and China and Japan. And 3 years ago, I went to visit I have about 100 software developers in Bangalore, and I went to visit
Southern India. Yep.
Yes, and I went to visit them and took them all out for dinner and just got to talking with them and was so impressed. I knew they were very, very smart in math and science, but I was so impressed with their knowledge of European history, American history. They could name more U.S. presidents than I could. Now, these are 25 to 35-year-old young men and women, and they were very globally aware. They knew what was going on in the U.S. and what was going on pretty much everywhere. And I said, you know, how did you get this smart? Where did all this come from? And they said it came from our education system. So I decided to first, I visited some of the colleges that they went to, the Indian Institute of Technology, which Bill Gates considers the finest engineering school in the world, and the Indian Institute of Management. And then I just kind of worked my way upstream. I went to high schools that they went to. I went to middle schools and ultimately went to grade schools. And kind of the seminal moment for me was I was in a first grade class in a school called the National Public School in Bangalore, and with 5 and 6-year-old children. And I asked the teacher, can I ask your children one question? And the one question was, what do you want to be when you grow up? And what I heard from these 5 and 6-year-old children, one by one around the room, was engineer, scientist, cardiologist, doctor, fighter pilot.
How old are these kids?
These are 5 and 6 years old. Mm-hmm. And I was, I mean, my heart stopped. I was stunned that children at that young of an age had set such lofty career goals. And that led me to then want to meet some kids that were the same age as my two girls. I have two teenage girls at that time, 13 and 11, now 15, 13. And so I asked, can I meet some girls that are the same age as my girls? And they said, sure. And so I sat down with a few of them. And I said, tell me about what you're studying. And I was stunned that they were 2 and 3 years ahead academically of my girls, who go to a very expensive private school and make straight A's. Mm-hmm. They're very good students. But the Indian and Chinese students were ahead in math, physics, chemistry, biology, world history. And so I came back and completely changed how my daughters are educated now, and started telling my friends about it. And I wrote a book about it, but the book didn't really convey. You have to see it to believe it. And so I hired two great documentary filmmakers, Chad Heater, who is the director, and Adam Rainey, the line producer. And we had three film crews go to three high schools in the U.S., India, and China, and to see how high school students allocate their 2 million minutes.
It's fascinating to see them side by side the camera in the classrooms with the kids on their way to and from school at their tutorial lessons early on Saturday mornings. U.S. kids out on the athletic field very often when the others may not be. It's not all nose to the grindstone, though. There's a little bit here from India, where one of the young men that you're looking at, a high school student there, Rohit Sridharan, is hanging out with some of his buddies, just to remind us that in all of these countries, these are kids who know how to have fun and like to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your Honor, please, got really what I say. What I will tell,
sir,
just the other day.
So, Rohit Sridharan and his buddies hanging out in a casual moment there with some kind of, it sounds like hip-hop goes to India a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, they have their own boy band, and they have, as he says, they have tried to make it big, and they're still trying. So, but they do go out and perform.
But here he is talking a few minutes later about how they see kids in the United States, what it means to be a high school student in the U.S. Here's the Indian, one of the Indian students, Rohit Sridharan, looking at the U.S.
If you're 17 in the United States, it means you have a driving license for a car, which you don't get here. And, you hang out much more. You have your opportunities are on a whole scale. In India, once you're 17, you're probably already decided what you're going to do. Yeah, they have much more fun, I can say. Because, we are almost all the time cooped up studying.
Here we are in India, we're cooped up studying, but we know what we're going to do. The American kids have got their driver's license, they've got their car, they have more fun. Is that the picture? Is it really American kids kind of partying down while India and China, educate to eat their lunch? Is that your conclusion?
Well, I think that's what the film shows. The film takes you into the schools, into the homes, into the hangouts of the teenagers in all three countries. And the Indian and Chinese teenagers are much more serious about academics. And they're more serious about it because that's what their culture rewards. That's what their parents want them to do. And so, for example, in India, if your child shows some gift in physics, for example, you'll go out and a parent will make a lot of financial sacrifices to hire the best physics tutor they can find to help their child get even better at physics. Now, in America, if your son shows some prowess at pitching in baseball, you'll go out and you'll hire a pitching coach for him. And you'll send him to a baseball camp, and you'll go to every one of his games, and you'll travel around the country, and that's how you show your love here. The family expectations are very different. There, they believe that a focus on building their intellectual foundation in high school is the role of the child, and the role of the family is to support them in that, and the role of the community. The things we reward in our country are very different than on a community basis than India.
But we do reward academic achievement. Kids want to get into great colleges. A lot of American kids work awfully hard to do that. Is that work not at the same intensity?
We don't reward our children for academic achievement. When was the last time?
Well, but yes, we do.
Well, people
are very focused on where they go to college very widely. I've seen that.
Oh, focused on where they go to college.
Well,
yes.
That's a kind of the plum at the end of the high school game, right? Everybody's aiming just as high as they can or very widely for where they go to college.
That's not what the film shows. The two students in Carmel, for example, are very, very bright, top students in their class.
Carmel, Indiana, beautiful high school, beautiful facility. Everybody's clean and bright and having fun.
$30 million football stadium, indoor Olympic swimming pool, 3,500-seat performing auditorium,
yeah.
a public high school. And with families that come from socioeconomic backgrounds that are upper middle class, mm-hmm. And yet the students don't work very hard academically when you compare them to the way the students are in India. So they're, Now, everybody shows up Friday night for the football game. That they reward. That we get excited about. When the quarterback, this is not in the film, but when a quarterback at a high school team gets signed at the University of Michigan, you have a big rally. When the brightest math student in your high school gets signed at MIT, for example, do we have a big rally? Does everybody come out and cheer his success or her success? No, we don't do that.
But in India?
In India they do, yes. We take the SATs here to get into college. Mm. 3 hours. 1 hour of math, 1 hour of English, 1 hour of writing. They take the CBSEs, 15 hours of exams over 3 days, 3 hours of math, 3 hours of physics, 3 hours of biology. And the top 500 students, the ones mm-hmm. who score the highest, mm-hmm. are published in every newspaper in the country.
And the 2 million minutes they spend in high school, let's just say in India, the way those are allocated versus an American student's time?
Well, yes. They don't go out on dates. They don't go to football games. There are no inter-school sports. They do play sports for fun and mm-hmm. exercise, mm-hmm. but they don't train year-round to play high school football. They don't do weight training and speed training. And so they
work at McDonald's on the weekend for gas money.
Well, Neil in the film works at Fazoli's, and he's worked there for a year and a half.
Fast Italian food.
And as I told Neil, I said, Neil, you learned everything you need to know about cooking spaghetti in 2 days. You didn't need to work there for a year and a half. And those 20 hours a week you spent slinging spaghetti, the Chinese and Indians were studying.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new documentary that compares high school years and high school education in the U.S., India, and China. It's called 2 Million Minutes, and it is eye-popping. The executive producer, Bob Compton, is with us. He's a venture capitalist who looked at what was going on in education in two big countries who are big competitors in this globalized era. And, he decided he just had to do more. We're going to hear from some of the participants, one American in particular. Let's go to him right now. He joins us from West Lafayette, Indiana. Neil Arndt is with us. He's one of the students featured in the documentary. He was a senior in high school when the camera crews came through for 2 Million Minutes. He's now a freshman at Purdue University, majoring in computer graphics. Neil Arndt, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
It's great to have you. You sat and talked with the film crew when they came by, and then you saw the documentary mm-hmm. and saw what was going on in Indian and Chinese high schools. What did you think, Neil, when you looked out from Indiana at India, at Shanghai?
It was pretty surprising. I think I already had an idea of, well, of course, the Indian and Chinese study harder than I do or than my peers do, but I don't think I realized it to the extent that it's shown in the film.
What struck you the most about their lives, their school days, the way they study, their attitude, Neil?
There's one part in the film where the Chinese boy is talking about, you know, what he does in his free time. And he says that, you know, maybe on Christmas his friends will go out and they'll sing karaoke and have fun. But other than that, his friends wouldn't hang out during the week. They wouldn't hang out on the weekend. They wouldn't spend their free time socializing. And for an American student, that's mind-boggling. That doesn't even make sense that you wouldn't spend, you know, a good portion of your time hanging out with friends.
Or the idea that you might just do it on Christmas, whatever that means in Shanghai.
Or the idea that singing karaoke is, you know, a pleasant way to spend an afternoon. But
at least that's fun. Let's hear a little bit from some of the gang that's interviewed in the film, Neil, in China. Here's Hu Xiaoyan, 17 years old, saying she understands that working hard is a way of life. She's in Shanghai. She was aiming, I don't know what happened, she was aiming maybe to go to school in the States, maybe to go to Yale. Here she describes her senior year in high school. It's in Chinese, but I'll give you a little bit of a sense of it.
Now, 高三学习是内是内，但是，嗯，我觉得这是一个是一种挑战，还有我总会有种感觉。Your
17-year-old Hu Xiaoyan saying the final year of high school here is hard and exhausting, but I take this as a challenge. I always feel that we'll have harder times in the future. I haven't really set a specific goal in terms of which university I should enter, but I hope to get into one of the top universities. You know, you heard a lot of these kids in Shanghai and Bangalore talking throughout the film. Yes, they may only play one day a year. That's amazing in itself. What about their attitude? Did they seem enslaved, oppressed by, you know, the intensity of their academic studies or not? Do you?
In a completely different attitude than we have there, where they look at, you know, rigorous studying as a challenge, we look at it as, you know, boring and not worth the effort. And that's a matter of incentive and, you know, what you really believe that extra studying is going to get you.
Do you think, now you're at Purdue, so, I mean, you've got a little different perspective, I suppose, but can you get what you want and need in life, the way you studied in high school? When you look at these clips of what's going on in Shanghai and Bangalore, does it look like the United States as a whole can compete with our style of high school stacked up against theirs?
I think for the time being, we are still a competitive nation, but I think it's a matter of how long is that going to continue in the future when their education just keeps improving and it's already ahead of ours, whereas we've grown pretty complacent. And, you know, how long are we going to be able to stay on top if this is our attitude towards education?
Here's a little bit from Apurva Upala, a 17-year-old high school student, about a day in Bangalore of studies. And this is her, she's describing a little bit of her Saturday. This is Saturday.
Yesterday, that was Saturday, I got up in the morning at 5:45, got dressed for tuitions, and then 2 hours in tuitions after that, did a bit of math and physics, and then went to breakfast with my friends. Then after that, straight to school, and I think after another half an hour, we had classes for 3 hours after that, without a break.
Up at 5:45 a.m., ready for what she was saying there was tuition, that is, being tutored. 2 hours of being tutored, then some math and physics, a little breakfast with friends, and then to school for 3 hours without a break. Neil Arndt, you're just out of the American high school realm. Do you imagine that one day Americans will have to study in this same way, with this same kind of schedule, for this country to stay competitive, or do we have just somehow a different style in this country?
I think it would take an entire cultural shift to get us to the point where studying on a Saturday like that wouldn't be considered ridiculous. And, you know, here, if you're studying on a Saturday, if you actually have to go to school on Saturday, you're probably in detention. You've done something wrong. It's not a way to get ahead. Whether or not we'll have to do that eventually, I'm not sure about that. I think that's a matter of whether or not we have to end up copying them or whether we can, you know, figure out a way to do something better. And who knows if we will.
You know, Bob Compton has gotten really inspired by this challenge and got invested in it. I know you and Bob have become close. Do you understand his, I don't know if paranoia is the right word, or just alarm at what he sees in the side-by-side comparisons, Neil?
Well, from his perspective, I mean, being a venture capitalist, being involved in companies across the world, you know, traveling to India, I think he has a perspective that not a lot of Americans get to see. From a business perspective, from a global economy standpoint, and if I were in those shoes and I was saying, well, you know, I've invested in all these companies, you know, the work coming out of India and China is just, you know, flat out superior. The education there is producing, you know, better workers for my company. If you're looking at that and saying, well, if that continues, if that increases, how is the American economy going to stay competitive?
Bob, you know Neil Arndt well at this point. Yeah. Say hi.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Bob.
And what are you suggesting in the documentary about the future for him and his peers? He's at Purdue now. He's the fruit of that American high school system. You have a sense of what he's and his peers are up against. What are you telling him? Despair? You didn't study hard enough? You're doomed? Or something else?
No, Neil and Brittany, like many American students, are
is Brittany another girl at the Carmel Indiana High School
that was focused on? She's the girl in the film. Mm-hmm. Yes, you know they're both extraordinarily bright, equally as bright as their Indian and Chinese peers, or peers in Europe for that matter. The issue is how you spend your time and what you spend your time on. You know, Tom, that if a Indian football team won the Super Bowl, it would be a national crisis in America. And we would look at how they were training, what they were eating.
If somehow they got into the NFL competition and
Bombay beat Boston or
beat the Patriots. Right.
It would be a national crisis. And we would be looking at how are they training? What are they eating different foods? How do they spend their time? And we would be studying every aspect of their lives to figure out how to beat them in football. Well, think of 2 Million Minutes as the scouting film for the economic competition of the 21st century. I'm showing in the film how Chinese and Indian students are spending their time. They are 2 and 3 years ahead of the same age students in America. I believe that if that continues, we will not remain competitive. And the example I'll give you is, I don't know if you've been to Detroit recently. Detroit is in an absolute depression. 30 years ago, people said the Japanese auto industry, now they'll never be able to beat us. GM will always be the largest auto manufacturer in the world. GM lost $38 billion last year, the largest loss in history, more than they made in the previous 10 years. Hundreds of thousands have left the auto industry. Mm-hmm. So to think that somehow we have some kind of divine right to permanent economic superiority is just crazy. You have to look at how the other team is practicing and see what they're producing. And if it's better, we have to step up.
Neil, do you feel the poker at your back now?
It's definitely made me realize more about the time I did spend in high school. Right now in my situation, it's made me realize, you know, what I'll be competing against after I get out of college.
Well, we wish you good luck with it, and thanks for the really interesting insight into your piece of this global pie. Neil Arndt, now at Purdue University. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's take a call, or I should say, let's go to New Delhi, India, and Vivek Wadhwa. He is in the documentary, 2 Million Minutes, has a fair amount of airtime about the challenges and differences between the educational systems that we're looking at here. He's a fellow at Harvard Law School, an executive in residence at Duke University, a tech entrepreneur who's founded 2 technology companies. He's been in India for the last 3 weeks studying the education system there. Vivek Wadhwa, thanks very much for being with us today.
Tom, thanks for having me on the show. I've actually been studying this for 3 years, and like Bob, I've been in the tech field. I've been worried about this problem for a long time. But I have a different perspective than everyone else seems to have. After studying it, what I've realized is that we're fixing the wrong problem. Yes, children here study very hard, and they have to, put in a lot more effort than Americans do, but they do it because they have to do it. The education system is not superior to the U.S. in any way. In fact, the education system is vastly inferior to the USA, yet India is rising in R&D. In China, they're spending massively in education. They're turning out PhDs and master's degrees at rates which are mind-boggling. However, China is not making the same progress that India is, despite all of that. Now, what I've realized after studying this intensely is that the issue isn't the K-12 education. The issue isn't we're teaching our kids enough math and science. The issue is that we're not training our workforce effectively. That the magic in India isn't happening in the schools that we're talking about. The magic is happening in the businesses that train them once they graduate and join the workforce.
Vivek, that goes against so much conventional wisdom in the United States. It says we've got a real problem. We're not spending enough time on school. We should go year-round. We need more homework. We're falling behind in science and math. You see the international test scores that show American kids back in the pack. And yet you've got a new essay out recently entitled The Science Education Myth, saying that we're not turning out too few well-trained, well-educated scientists. Are you so sure? That really flies in the face of what we hear all the time in the States.
I'm 100% sure, and I tell you, I've spent 3 years of my life researching this at Harvard and at Duke, and this is what worries me, that the U.S., there's a lot of reason to be concerned. Almost everything that Bob says is correct, that we are falling behind, that globalization is happening. His concern as a venture capitalist is pretty valid. However, what Bob hasn't studied is the next step. I mean, what happens to these kids when they join Indian businesses? why is it that they're succeeding? Because also he hasn't looked beyond the elite schools over here. It's one thing to look at the top 20 or 30 or 50 universities in India and China. But once you go beyond that, the quality falls off the cliff, that the graduates are largely unemployable in both countries. And companies have to spend months and months, typically 6 months to a year, before these kids become productive. On the other hand, American children, even though they may muddle around, they may do silly things and so on, by the time they graduate, actually they're seasoned. I mean, they've been around the block. They are mature. They have a business sense. They are grown-ups, and they can take on the real world very, very rapidly. And most importantly, they're creative and they're innovative. This is something which the rest of the world is trying to emulate.
Interesting. Okay, Bob Compton, venture capitalist and documentary producer. Here's Vivek, who you quote in the film, saying, lay off of American schools. You're doing just fine, thank you. It's actually the American business community that's not stepping up and somehow using the raw material that's offered to it by America's education system, that somehow it's Indian business that's getting more out of young Indians than American business getting out of young Americans.
Well, I would agree with Vivek that the Indian businesses do train students after they hire them. Where I disagree with him is if algebra is the highest level of math that you take in high school and take no more math in college, it is unlikely you will be a computer scientist after 6 months of training in a business. You have to have a high foundation knowledge, in my opinion, for the high wage, high growth industries, high tech industries of the 21st century. You have to have a high foundation knowledge in math, biology, chemistry, and physics. If you don't have that knowledge coming out of high school, I think it is a massive re-education issue. How do you take a 25-year-old who didn't even finish algebra and teach them calculus?
Can't be done, you're suggesting, or won't be done.
I'd rather teach them when they're 15 or 16, which is what is happening in Indian high schools. They are learning math and sciences at a much higher level than their peers.
Vivek Wadhwa in New Delhi, what about that? And why shouldn't the United States be looking at the new challenges from India and China as a kind of Sputnik moment when it comes to American education?
We should definitely improve math and science training. We should definitely improve the education system because ultimately it's good for us and it makes a lot of sense. But when we say that by teaching more math and science, and by graduating, the more engineers and scientists will become more competitive. That's false. I mean, we should do those things for the same reasons we improve healthcare and that we eliminate poverty, because it's good for the nation, it's good for our health, and it leads to a more effective workforce. But the fact is that there's no direct correlation between algebra and founding companies. I founded two technology companies. I tell you, I mean, my algebra was hopeless. I mean, I did study. I did complete good education. The fact is, most of the tech execs I know aren't good at mathematics. They just happen to be very creative, very entrepreneurial, and they can think differently and out of the box. That's a skill that you need. And by studying liberal arts, you get that skill. By studying the humanities, you get that skill because you get a broad education and you can become very effective.
Vivek Wadhwa in New Delhi, India, fellow at Harvard Law School, executive in residence at Duke University. Thanks very much for joining us today. Bob, just a word before the break. Vivek says, hey, look, I'm lousy at algebra, and I've founded companies like crazy.
Well, I have founded companies, too. I was a liberal arts major. I have no science background. But you have to have someone in the company that has science and math. He hired somebody to create the products. We can't all be liberal arts majors.
Right. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about a new documentary comparing high school years and high school education in the United States, India, and China. It's called 2 Million Minutes, and it is eye-popping to see in the classroom, around the breakfast table, when the tutor comes over, when the violin lessons are going on, late into the night, early in the morning, what's going on in Bangalore, in Shanghai, that at least in some elite schools that we're looking at here, that may or may not be going on in your high school or your child's high school. Here's a little montage from 2 Million Minutes, the documentary, where we hear from Brittany, a student at Carmel High School in Indiana, Rohit, a high school senior in Bangalore, India, and economist, former Labor Secretary Robert Reich.
My mom has always said that college was kind of a big step. It's just where you kind of learn to balance free time and studying. I want to join a sorority, which obviously you're going to party a lot, you have some fun.
In India, once you get into this academic course and you're serious about it, you don't have much of the option to choose between academics and something else. It's either academics and nothing else.
The people who are potentially losing their competitive edge are Americans.
There we are, from 2 million minutes. Now, here's just a little bit to just to keep us all humble. Here's the Fox Network's game show, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? And it throws grade school level questions to grown-ups. Here's 21-year-old Kelly Picker, country music pop star, tackling geography.
Budapest is the capital of what European country?
Budapest? I never even heard of that. I don't know. I'm just going to say France.
That is not the right answer. The right answer is Hungary.
Is what?
Hungary.
Hungary?
Like I'm hungry.
That's a country? I've heard of Turkey, but Hungary, never heard of it.
Okay, there we are from Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? The new documentary is 2 Million Minutes, and maybe that's an exaggerated little having some fun. On the other hand, it does make one think. Let's go to our listeners. A lot have been waiting to join. Brian is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Brian, what do you think about the picture being painted here?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, anyone who doesn't realize that Bob's documentary is precisely accurate is just in denial. I've been teaching high school 15 years, and we should be very alarmed, and that's even without looking at the Indian or Chinese models. There's such a complete lack of love of the gaining of knowledge. I often ask my high school students, most of them juniors and seniors, why do they think we're in school? The typical answer is to go to college, which is a circular answer. It doesn't really say anything. Why then do you want to go to college? To get a job. There's no substance in the answers. There's no kind of appreciation that there's a world of substance out there. And that young man who is now in Purdue, who spoke and said, we need, in a way, a cultural shift, he's also precisely correct. But the gentleman who then said, well, we in the liberal arts here in the United States, we're doing something right. That's of course correct as well. I'm by no means suggesting the Indian or Chinese models would work for this country. We do need to, in the world right now, be building Renaissance people, people who are well versed in the sciences, in the math curricula, and as well as in the humanities, advanced notions of political philosophy, the arts, etc.
Right, but Brian, let me ask you, you work in exactly these vineyards, so how might it work in the United States? Can you see that kind of cultural shift coming under the pressure of global competition? Can you imagine American high school students, you know, studying so many more hours a day, being tutored early on Saturday morning, going back to school on Saturdays, you know, sort of morning, noon, and night with their physics and algebra and calculus? Is that ever going to happen here? Will it have to happen here? What do you think?
A couple of points there. Number one, I'm absolutely speaking of competing in the global marketplace, number one. Number two, I don't think it's a factor of more time. It's a factor of quality of the school day. And this is not about the students. This is about the adults in this country who are in denial about what is going on in school. My students can attest, do not give a lot of homework. I would just as soon they go home, talk to their parents, enjoy themselves, but I get my pound of flesh out of them during the day, and I think the quality of our school day is not, it needs a complete paradigm shift in how we approach teaching based on brain research, based on who youth are, based on just too many factors.
Brian, it's fascinating to hear you say that. I have to say, having watched this documentary and seen the kids in Shanghai and Bangalore just studying, I don't know if you can make that up by some whiz-bang American procedural invention of education. It would sure be great if you could. But thanks very much for your call. Let's get one more from Timothy in Rochester, New York. Timothy, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. Yes, we can.
Yes. I'd like to say that respectfully, I'm just ashamed of this conversation. All of you are just so out to lunch. The fact is, you're discussing elites here. Class is the key issue. Whether it's China, India, or the United States, the problem is the vast majority of students. Just consider the demographics, the populations. They are the ones that aren't being served by any of this conversation because, for example, in the U.S. alone, they're lucky if they have an adequate school. It's the erosion of the school system in the U.S. It's simply having access to decent education in these other countries, and increasingly the United States, is the real issue. The reason the United States doesn't, Michigan, for example, doesn't have the auto workers that the industry needs, the competitiveness has been eroded, is because back in the 50s and the 40s and the 60s, and even in the 70s, the system was properly funded, the schools were solid, and you had something there where a child could go really get an education. The vast majority, not the elites.
So look beyond the elites. Timothy, I take your point fully there, and clearly in both Shanghai and in Bangalore, Bob Compton's camera crews are looking at rather well-off students, not rich, but certainly not poor. But let me ask you this, Timothy. The community that they profile in Indiana is clearly quite affluent. They've got a beautifully funded school. I mean, it looks like a country club. And still we see this vast difference in the way students go about being educated, even in that American setting. What does that say to you, Timothy?
Well, okay, it says to me that perhaps the priorities of that upper class, the elites, are not quite where they should be. Perhaps they have too much time on their hands because of all the money. But most of the students out there are struggling, you know, because they've got to deal with the schools, they've got to deal with crime, and if they're poor students and they live in the inner city, they've got to deal with working because, they have to help.
Of course, sure. Or if they're in rural China, they may be up to their knees in the rice paddy and not getting anything like this kind of education. It's a good point and well taken. Thanks for that, Bob.
Yeah, I did visit a rural school in India, 3 hours east of Bangalore in a little town, actually a village called Palapattu.
Mm.
And I was the first white person to ever come to this village, and so the entire village turned out to see me on a Saturday, 70 degrees, sunny, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And they said, "What would you like to see?" And I said, "I'd like to see the school." And they were delighted. So they took me out to the school. The school was three cinder block buildings. That day happened to be the 7th and 8th grade science fair projects. All the kids were in... And by the way, I should say the village is, it was one of my programmers, it's his ancestral village. His family's been farming rice and mango there for 500 years. And so this is a very poor village. I went in and I looked at these science fair projects, and they were every bit as good as the science fair projects you'd see at Boston Latin. They were outstanding science fair projects. The students could defend them. And you know what? These were the sons and daughters of rice and mango farmers, and they were in a concrete cinder block building getting a great education in nowhere India.
A lot to think about here. Let me bring into this conversation Shirley Ann Jackson. She joins us from Troy, New York. Shirley Ann Jackson is president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. She was in the Clinton administration. She was chair of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, contributed to National Academy's report that President Bush used as a blueprint for his competitiveness initiative. Shirley Ann Jackson, welcome back to On Point. It's good to have you here again.
Well, it's good to be here. Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Bob Compton and his crew have gone out and brought us a real up-close view of a high school life in these three countries. And it is very arresting in how different it is, how much more devoted, for how many more minutes and hours of the day, and with the kind of intensity the Indian and students seem to be. Does that look like an accurate reflection to you of what's going on in the world? And does that mean we've got a Sputnik moment of crisis here for the United States?
I think it is an accurate reflection. And let me just start by saying I want to applaud Bob Compton for creating a platform for discussing a very critical issue. I think it's fair to say that in countries where people have great aspirations for their economies to rise, to improve their living standards, to improve prospects, they're very focused, and the students are very focused. And what ends up happening is students respond to signals. Society sends signals. Parents send signals. It's a question of what do we value. And so I would say, from my knowledge, and I spend a lot of time in Asia, in India, we educate many Indian students, mm-hmm. many Chinese students. I would say they absolutely have the focus that the film
So is that a crisis for the United States? Can you know the kind of as our young guest earlier, Neil Arndt, said, it would take a sort of cultural revolution, it seems to me, for Americans to embrace this kind of intensity of education. Is that on our horizon somewhere? Are we going to be required to somehow emulate these systems?
I think we have to move in a way that makes sense for the United States. But let me frame it this way. Certainly, the United States has a really creative culture. We're very entrepreneurial. We've built great, great enterprises. And we have unique things in our national mentality and our appetite for risk, et cetera, that allows us to create great enterprises. But in the end, something, and I'm dating myself a bit, but in the end, something I always tell my own cabinet, my vice presidents, you cannot be the fuller brush salesman if you don't have brushes to sell. So in the end, you've got to have that knowledge base, the intellectual property, and in many ways, many of the great enterprises that we talk about are harvesting the ideas, the innovations, the technologies that have come out of decades of investment in research and development. It takes decades to educate, as I've said on many occasions, a high-performing scientist or engineer. And so I've talked about this as a quiet crisis because it is one that creeps in on cat's paws, that because of the time it takes to see the effect, including the time it will take for us to appreciate that a large proportion of the current cohort of scientists and engineers in this country are beginning to retire. By the time that recognition occurs, it's not something that we can address overnight. And so it's quiet in that way. It's a crisis because the work, the discoveries, the innovations that this group of people have brought us do form the basis of great enterprises and our economic strength and our national security. And so, again, it is quiet because of how it reveals itself. It is a crisis because it is the root of strength. And so the problem has been documented. It's not about counting heads to counting specific jobs. It is about national capacity for innovation. But innovation that is rooted in science and engineering capability. And so we really need to move to solutions.
Shirley Ann Jackson, Bob Compton, let me get another call or two, if I may. Loretta in Brookline, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have one question. How are the school systems abroad funded in comparison to how we fund ours, that is mainly by local property taxes, with almost complete autonomy for curriculum and curriculum standards and teacher standards by local school committees?
Right, Loretta, our time is short, and it's a good, clear question. Let me take it. Bob, can you speak to that in India and China and the schools you looked at?
Yes. In China, the schools are funded by the government, the communist government.
Federally? Like from top down or what?
To be candid, I don't know the exact mechanism, but
they're government funded schools. Very widely here as well, but it's the particular mechanism that determines who's got what.
Right, but they do set national standards in China. And in India, actually, a significant percentage of the schools are for-profit. About 20 to 30% of the students go to for-profit schools.
That's a lot.
And parents make enormous financial sacrifices to get their children into those schools. There also are government-funded schools. Again, in India, they have national standards in every subject. And so what is taught in the classroom is taught the same whether you're in Bangalore or Mumbai or Delhi.
Shirley Ann Jackson, do you see the financial structures around education determining the quality of outcome, the quality of education in comparatively between these countries?
Well, I think one could fairly say that there are massive investments in these places, but in a certain sense, we spend a lot of money per student here in this country to educate our young people without the concomitant results. So I think any solutions have to focus on what happens with teachers and teaching, what happens with the students in terms of expectation, preparation, and strength of curriculum, and what are our societal values in terms of valuing science and math and those who do them and those who teach them. You mentioned the President's American Competitiveness Initiative. We have the America Competes Act that was passed in the Congress. It came out of a bipartisan consensus, but it was not funded. I think national leadership is critical, both from the White House and from the Congress. And I'm hoping as we move through and into the next administration that we can have the kind of refocus. There certainly are both national and global challenges that are critical and that can form the focal points, energy security being key among them.
Mm. Shirley Ann Jackson, president of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, always great speaking with you. Thank you very much for joining us
today.
Thank
you, Tom.
Bob Compton, we've just got half a minute here. What's the message you want to leave Americans with? Is it, I mean, they could come away from this saying, oh my gosh, you know, we're doomed. But surely that's not why you set out to do this. What is the message you'd like to share?
We're not doomed. You know, our students have the intellectual capacity of any of the students around the world. What I hope people will do is see the film, look at how our economic competitors are training and preparing their students, and then ultimately it's got to be the parents' responsibility. The parents have to decide how they want to guide their children during the 2 million minutes of high school, which is what I've decided with my own daughters, to change their direction more toward academics.
The new documentary is 2 million Minutes. Bob Compton is executive producer. Bob, thanks very much for the film and for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.